I was having lunch in the main cafeteria in the hospital when an emergency page arrived for Dr. Tom Shires, chief of surgery. They informed us that the president had been shot and was being brought to the emergency room. We went there immediately, and he had just been brought in. It was obvious initially that he had a severe, lethal wound. There was a neck wound anteriorly and a large wound in his head in the right posterior area. I could not detect a heartbeat or pulse, but he was obviously moribund.
That's a guy named Malcolm Perry, who was one of the Dallas emergency doctors who tried to save John F. Kennedy's life on November the 22nd, 1963. Perry is talking there on the day after Kennedy's death, and he's recalling the scene the afternoon before when the president was wheeled into the emergency room at Parkland Memorial Hospital at around 12:40 p.m. He was obviously moribund, says Perry. There was a neck wound anteriorly and a large wound in his head in the right posterior area. In other words, Kennedy had a small hole in the front of his throat and a huge hole in the right side of his skull. That second wound was obviously going to be fatal. It was about 5 inches wide at its widest point, and parts of Kennedy's brain had visibly spilled out onto his hair and clothing. It was obvious at once that he had a severe lethal wound, is how Perry put it. But it was Kennedy's other wound, the wound in his throat, that was already becoming a bigger talking point for the early conspiracy theorists. On the afternoon of the assassination, around 2 hours after Kennedy was pronounced dead, Dr. Perry spoke to a group of reporters at Parkland Hospital. There's no audio of that press conference, but we do have a transcript. And when a reporter asked Dr. Perry to describe the wound on Kennedy's throat, Perry said, "The wound appeared to be an entrance wound in the front of the throat." Another reporter asked him, "Which way was the bullet coming on the neck wound?" And Perry replied, "It appeared to be coming at him." Perry's remark about the throat wound was quoted in countless newspapers the next day, and he wasn't the only emergency surgeon who said that Kennedy appeared to have been shot from in front. Another surgeon who'd treated the president told a newspaper, quote, "It certainly did look like an entrance wound." If Kennedy's throat wound was an entrance wound, that meant that the official theory about the assassination was in big trouble. According to the Dallas police, Oswald had been the lone assassin, and he'd shot Kennedy from the 6th floor of the Texas School Book Depository. But the book depository was located on the corner of Houston and Elm Streets, and Kennedy's limousine had already turned that corner, and it had travelled about 150 feet away down Elm Street before Kennedy was shot for the first time. So if Kennedy's throat wound was an entrance wound, the official claim that he'd been shot from behind by Oswald seemed to be in trouble. All over the country, assassination skeptics immediately understood that. In fact, it's fair to say that a lot of people became assassination skeptics because of this troubling inconsistency. And their suspicions intensified a week after the assassination, when images from the famous Zapruder film were published in Life magazine. Life had bought this sensational home movie footage of Kennedy's assassination from a dressmaker named Abraham Zapruder for $150,000. The full 26-second film wouldn't be seen by the public until 1975, when a grainy bootleg copy was broadcast on the TV show Good Night America. Until then, the still frames published in Life were all that the public had seen of the film. And when the first of those images were published a week after the assassination, they clearly showed that Kennedy's limousine was a long way past the book depository and that his back was fully turned to that building when he suddenly lifted his hands to clutch at his throat. So there was no question about it. If the throat wound was an entrance wound, Oswald couldn't possibly have fired that bullet. There had to have been a different shooter positioned in front of Kennedy, perhaps standing on the grassy knoll, which was about to become the most famous knoll in history. The throat wound was the trump card of early conspiracy theory. After all, the suggestion that it was an entrance wound had come from an impeccable source. It came from the doctors who'd tried to save the life of the dying president. If they were right, then that was slam-dunk proof that a conspiracy had occurred. At least one of the bullets that hit Kennedy must have been fired by someone other than Oswald. And if Oswald hadn't fired one of the bullets, then maybe he hadn't fired any bullets at all.
Sir, you feel that someone else other than Oswald did shoot President Kennedy?
I believe that if everything that the FBI, Dallas Police, Dallas DA version says is true, that is that one person alone participated in the assassination, and that Oswald was on the sixth floor of the Texas Book Depository building, that it would have been virtually impossible for Oswald to have been the one person. Because I think it is quite plain that the shots that were some of the shots, or at least one of the shots that was fired, which struck the president, was fired from in front of the president, not from the rear. That particular view is the view expressed by three doctors in Dallas who tried to save the president's life shortly after he was shot on November 22nd.
That's Mark Lane speaking in January 1964, just after Oswald's mother had hired him to act as her late son's attorney. As we saw in the previous episode, Lane was an incredibly dishonest man, and most of what he said about the assassination was rubbish. But when he talked about the throat wound, for once Lane had a valid point. And it wasn't just hardcore conspiracy theorists like Mark Lane who were talking about the problem of Kennedy's throat wound. A lot of reasonable people were talking about it too. A reporter covering the case wrote, "The question that suggests itself is, how could the president have been shot in the front from the back?" As long as that question remained unanswered, you didn't have to be a conspiracy theorist to believe that Kennedy had been killed by a conspiracy. In fact, given the available evidence, it seemed to be physically impossible that a conspiracy hadn't occurred. For any informed and reasonable observer, conspiracy seemed to be the best and maybe the only explanation of what had happened. My name is David Free, and this is The Ghosts of Dallas. The true story of John F. Kennedy's throat wound is complicated. In the end, the wound didn't prove to be the trump card that the early conspiracy theorists believed it to be. The true story is a story of coincidences and cock-ups on a grand scale. It's a story that's at least as colourful and full of twists and turns as the myths of the conspiracy theorists are, and the really fascinating thing about it is that it all actually happened. It shows us that real history, when you examine it, is much stranger and richer than the fairy tales of conspiracy theory. To begin to tell the true story of Kennedy's throat wound, we have to go back to the emergency room at Parkland Hospital at 12:40 p.m. on the afternoon of Kennedy's shooting, as Malcolm Perry and the other emergency surgeons desperately fought to save the president's life. And let's begin the story with a simple but important physical fact. In the emergency room, Dr. Perry and the other surgeons never turned Kennedy's body over. He arrived lying on his back, and he died lying on his back. At the press conference on the afternoon of Kennedy's murder, nobody thought to ask Dr. Perry if he had turned the president's body over, but here he is answering that important question a few years later in 1967.
You did not turn the president over.
No, there was no reason to. There was not time at that problem, and there was really no reason to. It made very little difference to me, since my immediate concern was with an attempted resuscitation.
The fact that the emergency surgeons never turned Kennedy's body over had at least two important consequences. At the start of this episode, we heard Dr. Perry say that Kennedy had a large wound in the right posterior area of his head. Many people have made the mistake of taking that word posterior too literally. But since Perry didn't flip Kennedy's body over, he obviously didn't mean to say that the big hole he saw was right on the back of Kennedy's skull. He meant posterior in a relative sense. Kennedy had a wound on the side of his skull that was located towards the back of the area that was visible to Perry. I'll have more to say about Kennedy's head wound later, but let's stick with the throat wound for the moment, and with the question of whether it was an entrance wound or an exit wound. The fact that Perry never turned Kennedy's body over should remind us that as an emergency surgeon, it wasn't his job to determine the nature of Kennedy's wounds and to decide which direction the bullets that hit him had come from. Perry's only job was to save Kennedy's life, or at least to try. Since that was his priority, he didn't take much more than a cursory glance at Kennedy's throat wound. In fact, here's Perry using that very word, cursory, to describe his examination of the wound.
What about this wound that you observed in the front of the president's neck? Would you tell me about that?
Yes, of course. It was a very cursory examination. The emergency proceedings at hand necessitated immediate action. There was not time to do more than an extremely light examination.
Again, Perry is talking there in 1967, and he's making a belated attempt to clear up the confusion and damage that had been caused by his public remarks in 1963, which was like trying to cram a genie back into the bottle. As Perry said there, his only job as an emergency surgeon was to deal with the emergency procedures at hand. The job of examining Kennedy's wounds properly, in a non-cursory way, would be done later on at his autopsy. And at the autopsy, the pathologists did, of course, flip Kennedy's body over, and when they did, they found two bullet wounds in the back of his body. One of these was a small, neat wound in the back of his skull, and this was obviously the entrance wound that lined up with the gaping exit wound in the side of his head. The other wound on the rear of Kennedy's body was a small, neat hole on the right side of his back, between the top of his right shoulder blade and his spine. This wound was at least roughly in line with the wound in Kennedy's throat, and if Dr. Perry had flipped Kennedy over and seen this additional wound, he then would have been in a far better position to say whether the hole in Kennedy's throat was an entrance wound or an exit wound. Here's Dr. Perry making that point in 1967, and again it would have saved everybody a lot of trouble if he'd made the same point in November 1963.
The determination of entrance or exit frequently requires the assertion of trajectory. And of course, this I did not do. None of us did at the time. There was no time for such things. The differentiation between entrance and exit wound is often made on a disparity in sizes, the exit wound generally being larger in the case of an expanding bullet. If, however, the bullet does not expand, if it is a full jacketed bullet, for example, such as used commonly in the military, the caliber of the bullet on entrance and exit will frequently be the same. And without deformation of the bullet and without tumbling, the wounds would be very similar. And in many instances, even the trained observer could not distinguish between the two.
Notice that Perry keeps saying there was no time. Kennedy was dying on the table in front of him, and Perry had to do everything in his power to try and stop that. And in his efforts to do that, he was about to do something that made any further examination of the throat wound impossible.
I could not detect the heartbeat or pulse. He was obviously moribund, having considerable difficulty with his breathing. At this point, I elected to do a tracheostomy to assist his breathing. Requested assistance from Dr. Kim Clark, Chief of Neurosurgery, Dr. Charles Baxter and Robert McClellan, attending surgeons, who came to my assistance immediately.
Kennedy was having trouble breathing, so Perry decided to perform a tracheotomy. That is, he decided to cut a hole in his throat and insert a breathing tube into his windpipe. So Perry grabbed a scalpel, and this is where we come to another one of those creepy coincidences that this case is so full of. The bullet hole in Kennedy's throat happened to be located in exactly the spot where a tracheotomy incision would normally be made. So Perry used the bullet hole as the basis of his incision. All he had to do was slice it open some more. This meant that any further inspection of Kennedy's soon-to-be-famous throat wound was about to become impossible, because the tracheotomy incision effectively made the bullet wound disappear. If the tracheotomy had saved Kennedy's life, the disappearance of one of his bullet wounds would only have been a tiny side issue. But of course, the tracheotomy didn't save Kennedy's life. Nothing would have. He was pronounced dead at 1 p.m., about 20 minutes after arriving at the hospital. That's where Dr. Perry's role in this story probably should have ended. But naturally, reporters at the hospital were eager to hear from him. When Perry faced them a little over 2 hours after Kennedy's death, they pressed him for information about Kennedy's wounds and asked him which direction the bullets appeared to have come from. Instead of saying that those were questions that should best be left to the pathologists, Perry made his fateful remark about the throat wound looking like an entrance wound, and that was the error that launched 1,000 conspiracy theories. We've all heard it said that Kennedy was shot from in front, from the grassy knoll. It's an idea that's never died, and the seed of that idea was planted when Dr. Perry told the press that the throat wound looked like an entrance wound. Perry immediately regretted having let the press badger him into saying this. In fact, he'd learned his lesson within 48 hours. At 11:30 a.m. on the Sunday, Perry was called into the emergency room again to try to save the life of the fatally wounded Lee Harvey Oswald. When Oswald died, Perry decided against holding a press conference. He handed out a written statement to reporters, and he didn't take any questions. "I had got a lot smarter in 2 days," Perry said later. Kennedy's autopsy took place at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland. It began at around 6 o'clock on the night of his death. The senior autopsy pathologist was Commander James Humes, and he was the man whose job it was to determine which direction Kennedy had been shot from. When Humes inspected the small wounds on the back of Kennedy's body, the wound on his shoulder and the wound in the back of his skull, he found that they both had the telltale characteristics of entry wounds. As for the exit wounds, there was no mystery about where the headshot had come out, because it had blown out that huge gaping hole in the side of Kennedy's skull. But the question of where the other bullet had come out was a mystery to Humes, because Dr. Perry's gory tracheotomy incision had removed all trace of the hole in Kennedy's throat. As we know, Dr. Perry had already told the reporters at Parkland Hospital about that wound, but nobody at the autopsy had got wind yet of what he'd said. So to Commander Humes and the other autopsy doctors, it wasn't immediately clear how the bullet that hit Kennedy in the back had got out of his body, or indeed if it even had got out of his body at all. Humes stuck his little finger into the back wound to see if he could probe the bullet's path, but he couldn't get his finger in beyond the first joint. He then had the body x-rayed to see if the bullet was still inside Kennedy's body, but the x-rays showed that it wasn't. And so what the hell had happened to it? Humes was temporarily stumped. As it happened, there were 2 FBI agents present at the autopsy as observers, and Humes and the other doctors started quizzing them about some left-field possibilities. Was it possible that the bullet had been made of ice or plastic so that it wouldn't show up on an x-ray? Or could a soft-nosed metal bullet have disintegrated inside Kennedy's body so thoroughly that an x-ray wouldn't detect any fragments of it? The FBI agents didn't know, so one of them left the room to ring the FBI firearms lab. The lab didn't think that any of those scenarios was very likely, but it did have some interesting news. Apparently somebody had found a slightly damaged but largely intact bullet on a stretcher at Parkland Hospital. Maybe that was the bullet they were looking for. The FBI agent went back into the autopsy room and relayed this news to Commander Humes, and Humes said that this probably was the bullet they were looking for. He said it was entirely possible that the bullet had gone just a small way into Kennedy's back and had become lodged there, and had then fallen back out onto his stretcher while the emergency surgeons were performing heart massage. This wasn't Humes's formal conclusion, though. At this stage, he was only speculating, using the evidence currently available to him. At a later point in the autopsy, he opened up Kennedy's chest cavity, and he found a contusion near the top of his lung, which showed that the bullet had in fact penetrated quite a long way into the body and wasn't likely to have fallen back out during heart massage. At this point, Humes began to suspect the truth. Kennedy must have arrived in the emergency room with an exit wound in his throat, and that wound must have been obliterated by the tracheotomy incision. Early the next morning, before finishing his autopsy report, Humes rang up Dr. Perry to check whether this hypothesis was right, and Perry confirmed that it was. So Humes now had the last piece of the puzzle, and when he finished his autopsy report later that day, he was able to give a complete account of Kennedy's wounds. One entry wound on the back of the right shoulder, corresponding to an exit wound in the throat, and an entry wound in the back of the head, corresponding to that dreadful exit wound on the side of the skull. When Dr. Perry testified to the Warren Commission, he was shown a copy of Humes's autopsy report, and he confirmed that the autopsy findings, quote, very nicely explained the circumstances as we observed them at the time. In other words, Perry was happy to defer to the autopsy pathologists and to concede that the wound that he'd wrongly believed to be an entrance wound was in fact an exit wound, which lined up with an entry wound in the back that he never saw. So on paper, there really shouldn't be any controversy about Kennedy's throat wound. Dr. Perry said that it looked like an entrance wound, but he was wrong, and his observation was quickly corrected by the findings of the autopsy doctors, who determined that Kennedy had been shot twice from behind, from a direction that was totally consistent with Oswald's position in the book depository. Perry's mistake about the throat wound might have given people like Mark Lane the best talking point that they would ever have, but really that talking point should only have remained good for 24 hours. From the moment Dr. Humes completed his autopsy report, the idea of a frontal throat wound was blown out of the water. Or at least it should have been. But nothing is ever simple in the Kennedy assassination. There's always a catch. And the catch about the autopsy report is that it wasn't made public until September 1964, when it was published as an appendix to the Warren Report. For the best part of a year, the public wasn't allowed to know what the autopsy doctors had found. In retrospect, this seems almost unbelievable. The question of Kennedy's throat wound was a question that struck many Americans as the most important question in the world, and the Warren Commission knew the answer to that question from the moment it took delivery of the autopsy report, and yet it sat on that answer for almost a year. The Warren Commission has copped a lot of criticism over the years, and most of that criticism has been hysterically off the mark, but one thing you can fairly criticise the Warren Commission for is its terrible communication skills. In that department, it did make a lot of unforced errors, and for my money, the Commission's failure to release the results of Kennedy's autopsy straight away was the worst own goal it ever scored. The Commission knew that the emergency doctors had said that the throat wound was an entrance wound. They knew that a lot of thinking people were worried about that. They knew that the talk of a frontal shot was getting out of hand and that conspiracy theorists like Mark Lane were making a lot of mileage out of all the confusion. The Warren Commission could have turned the whole issue into a non-issue by releasing the autopsy report as soon as it received a copy on December the 23rd, 1963. Instead, they let the issue fester on until September 1964 because they'd made that early policy decision to release no evidence or interim statements until their work was done. Meanwhile, Commander James Humes was under strict instructions not to discuss his autopsy findings with the press, so he wasn't talking either. All the people who knew the truth about Kennedy's throat wound were saying nothing. So for 10 long months, the mistaken observations of Dr. Perry and the other emergency surgeons were the closest thing the public had to an official word on the subject. So it's hardly surprising that conspiracy theory got off to such a flying start during that period of official silence. To add to the confusion about Kennedy's wounds, that meddlesome old shag J. Edgar Hoover decided that this would be a good time to reimpose himself on the assassination story. Hoover was troubled by the giant strides that conspiracy theorists were making during this period, so he decided to take matters into his own hands by leaking the results of the autopsy to the press. That might have been a good move if it wasn't for another one of those incredible catches that this story is so full of. Thanks to a series of keystone cops' errors, the FBI had managed to completely misunderstand the results of Kennedy's autopsy. Hoover thought he knew what the autopsy doctors had found, but he was wrong. So when he leaked the autopsy findings to the press, the details he leaked were incorrect. This meant that his attempt to shut down the early conspiracy theories backfired hilariously. Instead of making them shut up, Hoover just gave them more inconsistencies and errors to talk about. And the supreme irony here is that Hoover himself was the reason why the Warren Commission had taken its vow of silence in the first place. As we saw in the previous episode, the commission realized way back at its first meeting that the FBI was leaking things to the press and that a lot of the information it was leaking was unreliable. That's why the commission had decided to say nothing in public until its work was done, because it feared that piecemeal releases of information were starting to confuse the public. And now Hoover was about to leak even more false information into the vacuum that that policy had created. To understand how the FBI managed to become so confused about the results of Kennedy's autopsy, we have to go back into the autopsy room on the night of Kennedy's death. As I've said, two FBI agents were present in the room that night as observers. Their names were James Seibert and Francis O'Neill, and they later wrote a report about the autopsy for the FBI that's known as the Seibert-O'Neill report. This report had one enormous thing wrong with it, and you might already be able to guess what that was. The problem was that Seibert and O'Neill's account of the autopsy was based exclusively on what they saw happen in the room that night. They heard Commander Humes trying to work out where the back bullet had got to, they saw him probe the wound with his pinky, and they heard him say that it was entirely possible that the bullet had fallen back out of the wound when Kennedy was receiving heart massage. But Seibert and O'Neill were not present the next morning when Dr. Humes telephoned Dr. Perry and worked out that the bullet hadn't fallen out of Kennedy's back but had passed all the way through his body and exited his throat. That was arguably the most important finding of the whole autopsy, and Seibert and O'Neill had missed it. So when they submitted their formal report of the autopsy to the FBI, they wrote that the bullet that hit Kennedy in the back had penetrated, quote, a short distance inasmuch as the end of the opening could be felt with the finger. They added that the individuals performing the autopsy were at a loss to explain where the bullet had exited Kennedy's body until the mystery was solved by Dr. Humes's hypothesis that the bullet had fallen out of Kennedy's back. In other words, the Seibert-O'Neill report told only half of the true story of the autopsy, but it told it as if it was the full story. If anyone at the FBI had been thinking straight, they would have realized straight away that the Seibert-O'Neill report had to be wrong in at least one respect. It made no mention at all of Kennedy's throat wound. And yet by this time, everyone in the country who could read a newspaper knew that Kennedy had arrived at the emergency room with a bullet wound in his throat. Forget about whether that wound was an entrance wound or an exit wound, there could be no question that a bullet had pierced Kennedy's throat from one direction or the other. But Seibert and O'Neill's report of the autopsy didn't mention that wound. So either their account of the autopsy was incomplete, or else the autopsy pathologists had totally overlooked one of Kennedy's bullet wounds. Either way, somebody had made a disastrous mistake. And if J. Edgar Hoover had been playing with a full deck, and if he'd really been interested in getting to the bottom of Kennedy's murder, he would have realised that the Seibert-O'Neill report didn't add up, and he would have tried to find out what the hell was going on. But Hoover's overriding priority at that time was to get the FBI's final assassination report written and issued as soon as possible. Do it fast was the order that he'd sent out to his agents. So when the authors of the FBI's much-heralded assassination report came to write the section about JFK's autopsy, they didn't bother consulting Commander Humes, and they didn't wait until the FBI had received a copy of his formal report. Instead, they relied exclusively on the flawed observations of Seibert and O'Neill. So this is what the final FBI report said about Kennedy's back wound. Quote, medical examination of the president's body revealed that one of the bullets had entered just below his shoulder to the right of the spinal column, that there was no point of exit, and that the bullet was not in the body. As for where this bullet had got to, the FBI report sort of implied that it was the same bullet that was found on that stretcher at Parkland Hospital, but it didn't offer any explanation of how the bullet had got out of Kennedy's body and onto the stretcher. You might remember that when the members of the Warren Commission sat down to analyse the FBI's report, John McCloy said, "This bullet business leaves me confused." This was obviously the part of the report that McCloy was talking about, and it was things like this that made the Warren Commission decide that the FBI report was inadequate and couldn't be relied on, which meant that the Warren Commission would need to reinvestigate the assassination from scratch. And we can see now that it was a damn good thing that it decided to do that. When you look at it from a distance, the story of Kennedy's throat wound is like the parable of the blind man feeling the elephant. The guy feeling the elephant's trunk thinks that the elephant is a snake. The guy feeling the torso thinks it's a wall. And the guy feeling the leg thinks it's a tree. The emergency surgeons never turned Kennedy's body over, so they never saw the entry wound in his back. They told the press that the throat wound looked like an entrance wound, and the press told the public that. Meanwhile, the pathologists at Kennedy's autopsy never saw his throat wound because the tracheotomy incision had removed all trace of it. So on the night of the autopsy, Commander Humes said that the back wound had no apparent point of exit. The FBI agents at the autopsy heard him say that, and they thought it was a fact, and they put that pseudo-fact into their written report, and then the FBI reproduced the same mistake in its larger report. It's no wonder that the public became so confused about Kennedy's throat wound when the authorities were so confused about it themselves. Within 2 weeks of the president's murder, three very different official understandings of the throat wound were in play. The observations of the emergency room surgeons were wrong, but they were put on the record first. Then you had the official autopsy findings, which were right, but which wouldn't be made public for another 10 months. And then you had the weird halfway house of the FBI report, which was wrong, but wrong in a different way from the emergency surgeons. The FBI had a chance to correct its mistake in January 1964, when it delivered a second report about the assassination, which is known as the Supplemental Report. This report was short. It was only 67 pages long. And the idea was that it would include information that hadn't been available when the original FBI report was submitted. The Supplemental Report arrived at the offices of the Warren Commission on the 13th of January, and the staffers there naturally assumed that the FBI would take this opportunity to correct its account of the autopsy. By this time, both the FBI and the Warren Commission had a copy of the formal autopsy report. They'd both received it 3 weeks earlier, on December the 23rd, 1963. But instead of correcting that earlier mistake about the autopsy, the FBI's supplemental report weirdly repeated it. The new report said, quote, "Medical examination of the president's body revealed that the bullet which entered his back had penetrated to a distance of less than a finger length." At the offices of the Warren Commission, this sentence was read with something close to horror. It had been bad enough when the FBI screwed this point up once. The fact that it could make such a large mistake twice was seriously troubling. A lawyer named Howard Willens, who was a senior member of the Warren Commission's legal staff, wrote later, quote, "I was amazed by the enormity of this error. This was a serious mistake regarding one of the most critical factual issues in the investigation." And he continued, "The failure of the FBI to correct its earlier error on such an important matter created an immediate stir among the lawyers now on board. At the commission, we wondered what other, perhaps less detectable errors might be found in the FBI reports on the assassination and the murder of Oswald." It's useful to hear that the personnel of the Warren Commission developed such a low opinion of the FBI at the time, because in the mythology of conspiracy theory, it was instantly assumed that the Warren Commission and the FBI were working together in lockstep to hide the truth about the assassination from the American people. In the early conspiratorial books, the Warren Commission is portrayed as being just as wicked as the FBI, perhaps even more wicked. But that belief was nonsense, as Howard Willens has just reminded us. Right from the start, the Warren Commission knew that the FBI couldn't be trusted, either factually or morally. And the Bureau's unreliability on the facts was linked with its moral unreliability, because both things stemmed from the personality of J. Edgar Hoover himself. As Howard Willens put it, quote, "The FBI's rivalry with other agencies and its bureaucratic rigidity were well known in Washington, as were Hoover's titanic sensitivities," end quote. Hoover was a paranoid and deeply messed up man, and because the FBI reflected his character, it was an agency that was A, capable of making huge hasty errors about the assassination, B, incapable of imagining that it might have made any errors, let alone of correcting them, and C, arrogant enough to leak its mistaken conclusions in the belief that they were hard facts. As I've said, Hoover's leaking policy went into overdrive on the topic of Kennedy's autopsy, and those leaks would end up having disastrous effects on America's understanding of the assassination, and also on its long-term willingness to trust its institutions about anything. On December the 18th, 1963, almost a month after Kennedy's death, the New York Times and other newspapers published an Associated Press story about the results of Kennedy's autopsy. At that stage, the autopsy results were still meant to be top secret, but the Associated Press claimed to have been told the inside story about the autopsy by, quote, "a reliable source familiar with the autopsy findings." This source told the Associated Press that Kennedy had been struck from behind by two bullets. One of them had hit him in the head, and the other, quote, "made a small, neat wound in the back and penetrated 2 or 3 inches," end quote. But if that was so, then why had Kennedy turned up to the emergency room with a hole in his throat, as everybody now knew that he had? Well, the Associated Press's anonymous source had an answer for that question, as the report went on to explain. Quote, "Many observers were puzzled from the outset by the report of a throat wound, since it was well established that the assassin was firing from above and behind the president. The pathologists at Bethesda," the source said, "concluded that the throat wound was caused by the emergence of a metal fragment or piece of bone resulting from the fatal shot in the head." So whoever the anonymous source behind this story was, he knew that a lot of Americans were puzzled by the question of Kennedy's throat wound, and he wanted to assure people that this wound was in fact totally compatible with the belief that Kennedy had been shot from behind by Oswald. This must have sounded like reassuring news at the time, but given what we now know about Kennedy's autopsy, we can see that the Associated Press's supposedly reliable source actually had no idea what he was talking about. The pathologists at Bethesda certainly had not concluded that Kennedy's throat wound was caused by a flying chip of metal or bone from the headshot. The real autopsy report didn't say anything remotely like that. So what was going on? Where had this bogus information come from? Who was this mystery source who'd got his wires crossed so badly about the autopsy? It isn't hard to guess, given the clues that have been scattered through this story. This newspaper report had the fingerprints of J. Edgar Hoover all over it, because the FBI at that time was the only official agency that was A, aggressively trying to control the public understanding of the assassination through the newspapers, and B, under the impression that the bullet that hit Kennedy in the back had only penetrated 2 or 3 inches into his body. Also, the Associated Press wouldn't have said that its source was reliable and was familiar with the autopsy findings, unless it had good reason to believe that both those things were true. There were only a handful of sources that a reporter would have said this about, and the FBI was one of them. But if J. Edgar Hoover did leak this story, then where on earth had he got the idea that the throat wound was, quote, caused by the emergence of a metal fragment or piece of bone resulting from the fatal shot in the head? This was a novel suggestion. Nobody had ever said it before, and nobody would ever say it again. After cropping up in the newspapers just this once, this detail quickly vanished from the conversation. There was no justification for it anywhere in the official record, except perhaps in one place. In the supplemental report of the FBI, there was a sentence about a hole in the front of Kennedy's shirt collar, which vaguely implied that that hole might have been made by a fragment of the bullet that exploded in Kennedy's head. But that certainly didn't justify the claim that the autopsy surgeons had said the same thing about the hole in Kennedy's throat. So why did Hoover say that they had? Hard as it is to believe, it seems that Hoover at this point was so desperate to hose down the conspiracy theories about Kennedy's murder that he was ready to invent reassuring evidence out of thin air. He wasn't shrewd enough to guess that the FBI's understanding of Kennedy's autopsy was simply wrong, but he was shrewd enough to see that it didn't line up with the lone gunman story because it didn't explain how Kennedy's throat wound had been inflicted from behind. To resolve this problem, Hoover simply imagined autopsy findings that had never really been made. He bridged the gap, or squared the circle, by saying that the pathologists at Bethesda had reached conclusions that they hadn't really reached. It's possible that Hoover did this unconsciously without knowing what he was doing, but if he did know what he was doing, his behaviour was reprehensible. Because if the autopsy findings didn't explain how Oswald had put a hole in Kennedy's throat, and Hoover didn't seem to think that they did explain that, then really he should have been sending out his agents to find the second gunman who had put that hole in Kennedy's throat, instead of patching up the problem by making up imaginary autopsy results. Anyway, if Hoover thought that he could silence the early conspiracy theorists by planting false but reassuring stories in the press, he had a deeply deluded idea of how conspiracy theory works. I said a moment ago that the fragment of bullet or bone story vanished from the newspapers after making this one single appearance, but it certainly didn't vanish from the radar of conspiracy theory. The early conspiracy theorists were following the newspapers very closely at the time. They were clipping out all the assassination stories and filing them away. And this weird little story didn't escape their notice. It seemed to be proof of something, but what was it proof of? The conspiracy theorists didn't know yet, so they tucked this story away in their files, and they waited to see what use they could make of it down the track. Hoover's leak was like a time bomb, in other words. For a long time it ticked away quietly, forgotten by everybody except the conspiracy theorists, and then it finally exploded about 3 years later when the first batch of conspiratorial books came out. At least three of those books made big play out of the fragment of bone story. Those books were Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment and Edward Epstein's Inquest, both published in 1966, and Sylvia Marr's Accessories After the Fact, which was published in 1967. By the time these books were being written, the conspiracy theorists finally thought they could see what the leaked story about the autopsy meant. When the Warren Report was published, the official autopsy report that was attached to it had threatened to spoil the fun of the conspiracy theorists because it offered hard medical proof that Kennedy had been shot from behind, not from in front. But conspiracy theorists liked the idea that he'd been shot from in front. They liked all the beautiful theories that they'd built on top of that idea, and they didn't want to give them up. So after the publication of the Warren Report, it became mandatory for the conspiracy theorists to argue that the so-called official autopsy report that was attached to it was a fraud. This was their biggest new article of faith. The official autopsy report was a forgery, which had been cooked up to support the official idea that Oswald was the lone assassin. This was a pretty radical thing to believe, but the conspiracy theorists had to believe it to keep the idea of a frontal shot alive. And to prop up this radical belief, they needed all the evidence or pseudo-evidence they could find. That was the spirit in which they went back to their clippings files and dug out that old story about the exiting fragment of bullet or bone. Now they thought they could see what this story proved. It proved that there had once been a different autopsy report, the real autopsy report, which the Warren Commission had buried and replaced with the phony document it released to the public. In his book Inquest, Edward Epstein pointed to the leaked newspaper story as proof that, quote, the autopsy report published in the Warren Report is not the original one. Mark Lane made exactly the same move in his book. He said that the leaked story proved that the original autopsy report must have been, quote, withdrawn and then modified before being released. In a way, Epstein and Lane couldn't be blamed for believing this, because after all, the newspaper story had been credited to a reliable source, and the autopsy findings described by that reliable source certainly were different from the autopsy findings published by the Warren Commission. But in their rush to prove that something fishy had happened, Lane and Epstein seemed to have forgotten something quite important. The whole original point of the throat wound was that the emergency doctors had said it looked like an entrance wound, which meant that someone other than Oswald must have fired that particular shot. But if the newspaper leak really did point to the existence of an alternative autopsy report, and it didn't, but even if it did, this alternative autopsy report still evidently said that Kennedy had been shot twice from behind. The only difference was that the throat wound had been caused by a flying fragment of the headshot rather than by an exiting bullet. And why on earth would the Warren Commission have gone to the trouble of withdrawing and modifying this original autopsy report if it was still perfectly compatible with the claim that Oswald had shot Kennedy from behind? This was one of those times when the early conspiracy theorists got so carried away by their suspicions that they lost sight of the bigger picture and forgot about simple logic. Unfortunately, they were far from alone there. In the wake of Kennedy's murder, the general public sense of suspicion and paranoia was so thick that a lot of other people forgot about logic too. So when these early revisionist books were published, readers and critics didn't tend to notice that a lot of the claims in them didn't make any sense when you stopped to think about them. Not many people were stopping to think about these things at the time, and it was generally felt that writers like Epstein and Lane were onto something. And to be fair to both those writers, they certainly weren't wrong to feel that there was something fishy about this newspaper leak, because there was something fishy about it. J. Edgar Hoover was trying to control the story of Kennedy's assassination through the newspapers, and his ham-fisted attempts to do that offer us a kind of masterclass in how not to deal with conspiracy theory. The early conspiracy theorists were far from stupid. In fact, they were a lot smarter than J. Edgar Hoover was. They knew a lot more about the finer points of the evidence than he did, and their eyes were constantly peeled for slips and inconsistencies in the official story. Hoover's idiotic leaks only gave them more slips and inconsistencies to feed on. He was like a man trying to put out a fire by hosing it with kerosene. The Warren Commission dealt with the conspiracy theorists in a different way, a far more laid-back and hands-off way. And it has to be said that their approach wasn't all that effective either. The Commission had a kind of old-fashioned, paternalistic faith in the power of reason and evidence. The message that the Commission effectively sent out to the American people was, sit tight and relax, and in the fullness of time, we'll give you all the answers you're after. For 10 months, we'll leave you alone with all the press speculation and with the theories of people like Mark Lane, and at the end of that period, we'll tell you the whole truth and you'll see the light. But human psychology doesn't work like that. We're not wired to be that patient. By the time the commission published its staggeringly thorough report in September 1964, the horse of conspiracy theory had bolted. Too many people had fallen in love with their conspiratorial beliefs, and they weren't about to let go of them. For example, listen to Sylvia Marr, who wrote the book Accessories After the Fact. She's speaking here in 1967 to publicise the release of that book, and she's explaining how her suspicions about the assassination deepened as she followed the coverage in the newspapers and the magazines.
Well, in common with many other people in this country, I found that the initial story out of Dallas on Friday the 22nd of November 1963 was so highly implausible and unconvincing that I began from that day to follow with very great interest all the information that was published during the succeeding year, published in the press and in the magazines. And at no point during that time did I find that there was coherence, plausibility, and directness. In fact, I think it is extraordinary how many revisions continually took place, unabashedly, revisions of the evidence that flowed through the papers, especially the revisions of the autopsy and medical findings, an area of evidence which should not have been subject to so many contradictions and changes.
Sylvia Marr was an observant person, and there's a lot of truth in what she just said there. In the 10 months before the Warren Report was published, somebody behind the scenes was manipulating and revising the official story through the newspapers, and this person or agency was indeed paying special attention to the medical findings and did seem to have a great deal of trouble giving a coherent and consistent account of them. Ma was right about all that, but she went disastrously wrong when she imagined that the Warren Report was part of that same manipulative project. In truth, the Warren Report was the antidote to all that earlier confusion and spin, but Ma saw it as more of the same. She saw it as just one more official attempt to revise or whitewash the truth. The mistake she made was a signature mistake of conspiracy theory. She imagined that there was such a thing as the official story. She imagined that there was a single official mind that kept pushing out its predetermined narrative through the press. She imagined that everyone in power was on the same page. But by now we've seen ample evidence that this wasn't true. The true story of the Kennedy assassination offers us some useful general lessons about history and the way things really work, and the lesson that Sylvia Marr teaches us here is when you're trying to interpret the actions of human institutions, don't overread the evidence. Don't leap to the conclusion that things are sinister when there might be an innocent explanation for them. Sylvia Marr gave America's institutions too little credit and too much credit at the same time. She imagined that they were far more wicked than they really were, but she also imagined that they were far more competent than they really were. Official competence was actually pretty thin on the ground in the days and weeks after Kennedy's assassination. Think of all the people in this story who made innocent but quite large mistakes under pressure, from Dr. Perry's mistake about the throat wound, to Seibert and O'Neill's mistake about the autopsy conclusions, to the nameless FBI agent who wrote the Bureau's supplemental report without even bothering to consult the official autopsy findings. Hoover's FBI would barely have been capable of organising a piss-up in a brewery, let alone of participating in a smoothly functioning conspiracy to hide the truth about Kennedy's murder. At an early meeting of the Warren Commission, Dick Russell said, "I have never understood why it is that every agency behaves as if it's the sole agency in the government." That was the true story of how America's government agencies behaved after Kennedy's assassination. There was a real scandal there, but it wasn't a scandal where everybody in power worked together to deceive the American people. It was the scandal of the FBI versus everybody else. Unfortunately, this fact caused the Warren Commission to make another one of its large tactical blunders. The Commission declined to say anything negative about the FBI in the Warren Report. If the Commission had come clean about the FBI's misconduct and the shoddiness of its investigation, then people like Sylvia Marr would have been alerted to the real scandal behind all those changing press reports about the assassination. But in 1964, government agencies didn't slag each other off in print. They did it behind each other's backs, but not in print. It just wasn't the done thing. So instead of being honest about the FBI, the Warren Report made a sort of polite bureaucratic attempt to sweep the FBI's contributions under the rug. On page 3 of the Warren Report, there's a sentence saying that the two FBI reports were, quote, of principal importance in helping to guide the Warren Commission's own investigation. And after that single mention, neither one of the FBI reports is ever referred to again in the whole of the Commission's 888-page report. And no part of either FBI document was reproduced in the 26 volumes of documents and evidence that the Warren Commission published to support its findings. This was a fairly conspicuous omission, given that the Commission did find room in those volumes for such obscure items of evidence as a microphotograph of Oswald's pubic hairs. And after the Warren Report was published, copies of both FBI reports were quietly deposited in the National Archives. This was yet another move taken from the playbook of how not to combat conspiracy theory. Obviously, it was only going to be a matter of time until some intrepid researcher gained access to those archived FBI reports or managed to get their hands on one of the rogue copies that was still at large. And because the Warren Commission hadn't told the truth about how useless those FBI reports were, the conspiracy theorists who found them were going to have every excuse to seize the wrong end of the stick yet again. They were going to be free to imagine that the FBI reports had been buried not because they were garbage, but because they were dynamite.
It was just a very short, brief summary report that was written by some guy in the FBI.
That's a Warren Commission lawyer named Wesley Liebler. It's December 1966, and Liebler is appearing on a radio talkback show in San Francisco. The name of the segment is In Defense of the Warren Report, and by December 1966, the Warren Report needed a lot of defending. By this time, the buried FBI reports had been discovered by conspiracy theorists, and the inevitable had come to pass. The conspiracy theorists were saying that the FBI reports revealed the hidden truth about the assassination. The first wave of conspiratorial books had appeared by now, including Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment and Edward Epstein's Inquest, and both Lane and Epstein had used the FBI reports to boost their claims that the Warren Report was a fraud. A caller who rang into the radio show had read both their books, and he had a pretty reasonable question for Wesley Liebler. If the FBI's reports about the assassination were so useless, as the Warren Commission's defenders were now claiming, then why hadn't the Commission simply said that in its own report?
What I'd like to know is, why can't you tell from reading the Warren Report itself that the FBI had submitted two reports to the Commission that were so completely wrong on such a major issue? This is just not present in the Warren Report.
Let me try to respond to that.
Yes.
I think the reason that it wasn't is because it just, very frankly, I can't see you, I can only respond by the way I hear your voice. I think you're asking a serious question, and I try to answer it in a serious way, as we always do. It seems to me that the reason we didn't talk about this is because it just didn't seem important to anybody. It was just a very short, brief summary report that was written by some guy in the FBI who was, in a sense, trying to do in a very short period of time, in a couple of weeks or in a couple of months, the job the Commission took 9 months to do. Nobody paid any attention to it. Now, that's simply a fact. I know I came down there, I read it through once, I threw it aside, and I never looked at it again.
But the caller was tenacious, and he was very well informed, and he had a pretty decent follow-up question. If what Liebler said was true, if nobody at the Warren Commission had paid any real attention to those FBI reports, then why did the Warren Report say, right there on page 3, that the FBI reports had been crucial to the Commission's own investigation? Again, this was a fair question, and it caused Wesley Liebler to snap and to say something that people in 1966 almost never said.
The report says, quote, "Of principal importance was the five-volume report of the Federal Bureau of Investigation submitted on December 9, 1963, which summarizes it. Do you think that's not an accurate statement?
Not an accurate statement. That's quite right.
I say, well, that's, I think that answers.
You want to get right down to the hard-nosed facts as to why it's there?
I suppose
nobody wants to pick on the FBI any more than you have to. Let's face it. Why dredge up the mistakes of the FBI if they're not relevant to what's going on? And if you know what the facts are, you go ahead and set forth the facts.
There it was in a nutshell. The FBI had screwed up, and the Warren Commission had been too polite to say so. And now the Commission was paying the price for its politeness. The FBI reports had turned up like a bad penny, and people had mistakenly concluded that it was the Warren Commission that was full of shit, rather than the FBI. To add to the irony, it was Wesley Liebler himself who had let the FBI reports out of the bag. On June the 30th, 1965, 9 months after the publication of the Warren Report, a young academic researcher had come to visit Liebler at his farmhouse in Vermont. The name of that young researcher was Edward Epstein. At the time, Epstein was a student at Cornell University, and he was writing a master's thesis about the work of the Warren Commission. Within a year, Epstein would end up turning that thesis into his book Inquest, which would become a bestseller. In the course of researching his thesis/book, Epstein interviewed 5 of the 7 members of the Warren Commission, along with several of the young attorneys who had worked on the Commission's legal staff. One of them was Wesley Liebler, and it was Liebler who gave Epstein some of his juiciest scoops. He told him off-the-record stories about the general cluelessness of the 7 Warren Commissioners. Apparently, the legal staff had nicknames for them, borrowed from Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs. Justice Earl Warren was Dopey. Alan Dulles was Sleepy, because he tended to nod off while witnesses were testifying. And Marina Oswald was Snow White, because Liebler and the other lawyers thought that the commissioners treated Marina far too reverently and didn't notice her tendency to tell lies about how much she had known. Edward Epstein's interview with Liebler went into the small hours of the morning, and he wound up staying the night at Liebler's farm. When Epstein drove back to New York the next day, Liebler let him take away 2 cardboard boxes full of Warren Commission files. When Epstein got home and rummaged through those cardboard boxes, he found copies of both FBI reports in there. For an assassination researcher, this was the motherlode. Nobody outside the Warren Commission and the Justice Department had ever laid eyes on the FBI reports before, and it would be another 8 months before any other researcher gained access to the copies in the National Archives. For the moment, Edward Epstein had the FBI reports to himself. What happened next was pretty much inevitable. When Epstein read the FBI's muddled account of Kennedy's autopsy, he wrongly concluded that he'd stumbled on the hidden truth about the autopsy, and therefore about the assassination itself. He was no longer just a humble student writing a master's thesis. He was a man who held the key to the assassination. He was sitting on the ingredients of a bestseller that could blow the lid off the whole case. In late 1965, Epstein started shopping a draft of his manuscript around to publishers. In June 1966, Inquest was published amid an inferno of hype. The book's sexiest selling point was that it had an appendix containing 50 pages worth of excerpts from the FBI reports. These pages were Xeroxed directly from the original documents, and they looked very exciting and illicit. And the main argument of Epstein's book was based on a close reading of these Xeroxed pages. If the FBI reports were accurate, Epstein wrote, that meant that, quote, the autopsy report published in the Warren Report is not the original one. And if the autopsy report was a fraud, then so was the whole Warren Report. and the whole idea that there had been no conspiracy. As Epstein put it, if the FBI reports were accurate, then it was, quote, not physically possible for a lone assassin to have accomplished the assassination. Epstein's book made a big splash with the American public. When Wesley Liebler appeared on that talkback radio show in December, the worried callers who rang in with questions for him mentioned Epstein's book at least as often as they mentioned Mark Lane's. But unlike Mark Lane, Epstein wasn't a charlatan. He was a serious writer who had followed the evidence, and given the evidence available to him, you can easily see why Epstein reached a conspiratorial conclusion. History had set a kind of cruel trap for him. With a helping hand from J. Edgar Hoover, it had laid out the clues for an orgy of conspiratorial misinterpretation, and Epstein gobbled up every last one of those juicy clues, like Pac-Man eating his way into a corner. He must have thought that his case for conspiracy was watertight, but from our vantage point we can see that he was groping around in the dark and that he kept tripping and stumbling over things he didn't know about and couldn't know about. During the Iraq War, Donald Rumsfeld was widely ridiculed for coining the idea of the unknown unknown. But there were serious philosophers who leapt to Rumsfeld's defense, and they pointed out that the unknown unknown was in fact a valid concept, and it's certainly a useful concept for analyzing what went wrong with Edward Epstein's inquest. The lesson that any other potential conspiracy theorist should learn from Epstein is beware of the unknown unknown, especially when you're trying to interpret history on the fly. For example, one of the premises that Epstein based his whole argument on was his belief that, quote, there can be no doubt that the autopsy findings were known to the FBI when it prepared the summary report. Epstein thought that he had ironclad reasons to believe that. Two FBI agents were present at the autopsy, he pointed out, and at least one of those agents had remained in the room at all times. That was perfectly true, but Epstein's whole point was ruined by the unknown and unguessable fact that the autopsy findings weren't finalized until the next morning, when Commander Humes rang Dr. Perry to talk about the tracheotomy. Epstein also dug up the old fragment of bone story from the newspapers, as we've seen, and he used that as further proof that the FBI reports had to be accurate. But the unknown unknown here was that the leaked story had come from the FBI itself, and so it was poisoned fruit from the same poisonous tree. Finally, Epstein played his trump card. He pointed out that the FBI's supplemental report, which was issued more than a month after its first report, contained an account of the autopsy that was identical to the account given in the first document. And there was no way, Epstein said, that the FBI could have made, quote, a repeated error of this magnitude. But the unknown unknown here was that Hoover's FBI was capable of making a repeated error of that magnitude, and in fact had done exactly that. The spooky thing about Epstein's inquest is that it very capably brought together all of the evidence of what had actually happened. The truth was right there under Epstein's nose, and if he'd been ready to see it, he could have written the true story of the FBI's performance long before anyone else did. In fact, for half a sentence, Epstein had his hands around the whole truth. He admitted that it was theoretically possible that the FBI had simply made a large error and then repeated it, but Epstein couldn't bring himself to believe that that was indeed what had happened. He dismissed the idea as inconceivable, and he let the truth slip out of his fingers. Somehow he found it more conceivable that the Warren Commission had knowingly falsified the autopsy report. As a student of American history and government, Epstein should have seen that he was backing the wrong horse there. It actually wasn't all that inconceivable that a rigid bureaucracy like the FBI would make an error of that kind twice. Certainly you could believe that without having to adopt a radically new conception of the way America worked, but to believe that the Warren Commission had scrapped the real autopsy report and published a fake one, you did have to imagine that American history had taken an unprecedented and very dark turn. You had to believe in the existence of the kind of immense conspiracy that's never really happened anywhere except in the mythology of conspiracy theory. Unfortunately, Epstein was working in an atmosphere in which the idea of a massive conspiracy had come to seem way more plausible than it really was. By the time he completed the final draft of his book, Epstein had started to move in conspiratorial circles. He was rubbing shoulders with people like Sylvia Marr, who ran a kind of salon in her New York apartment for assassination skeptics. Epstein had become the star attraction in that salon because he was known to have gotten his hands on the holy grail of the FBI reports. So in that heady conspiratorial atmosphere, Epstein lost his perspective. His sense of what was possible and realistic became skewed. But to Epstein's credit, he didn't lose his perspective forever. As I've said, he wasn't a Mark Lane-style opportunist and liar. He was a misguided true believer who had a genuine respect for evidence. And to prove that, Epstein later admitted that he'd been wrong about the question of conspiracy. He changed his mind, which is something that conspiracy theorists almost never do. In 2007, Epstein pointed out that 40 years had now gone by since Kennedy's murder. If there really had been a conspiracy, the proof of it had had ample time to come out, and as Epstein now admitted, the proof had just never arrived. "It's the passage of time," Epstein said. "As we covered decade after decade, not a shred has come out that would indicate what this conspiracy was. After 40 years, none of the theories pan out." End quote. In this episode of the podcast, I've done my best to be fair to the early Kennedy conspiracy theorists. I've tried to show that their theories didn't come out of nowhere. The conspiracy theorists were wrong about the assassination, but in those early days, they did have plenty of good-looking reasons to be wrong about it. For a while, the throat wound was the best-looking reason of all, and we've seen how the early confusion about that wound helped to fuel the thinking of three of the biggest names in early conspiracy theory: Edward Epstein, Mark Lane, and Sylvia Marr. These three people were very different. They show us that conspiracy theorists come in different shapes and sizes. Sometimes in this podcast, for the sake of convenience, I've spoken as if all conspiracy theorists are the same and use the same tactics and think in the same way. But as we get deeper into this story and zero in on these individual names, it should be becoming clear that all conspiracy theorists are not the same and shouldn't be condemned equally. They're scattered along a kind of spectrum. At one end of the spectrum, the cynical end, you have the outright liars and charlatans like Mark Lane, also known as the conspiracy entrepreneurs. Edward Epstein came from the other end of the spectrum, the decent and rational end. He believed in a conspiracy because the evidence available to him suggested that a conspiracy was the most likely conclusion, and when the evidence stopped suggesting that, he stopped believing in conspiracy. Sylvia Marr was a more typical conspiracy theorist. She sat somewhere between those two extremes. She was a decent person, and she didn't consciously deceive her readers the way Mark Lane did, but her capacity to deceive herself and to keep deceiving herself was a lot more pronounced than Edward Epstein's was. Epstein and Lane were outliers. Most conspiracy theorists aren't like either of them. Most conspiracy theorists are like Sylvia Marr. They sincerely believe what they say, but they have an uncanny ability to explain away or ignore the evidence that proves they're wrong. They also have a tendency to pounce and to hang on tight when people in authority make some mistake that seems to support their case. So one way that official agencies can discourage conspiracy theory is to be careful in their public statements and not to talk about the evidence until they're sure what the evidence says. But as we've seen, in this case, the landscape was generously strewn with official mistakes. Most of the misinformation about Kennedy's throat wound came from official or quasi-official sources who didn't know what they were talking about. And the silence of the official agencies that did know the truth made matters even worse. Sometimes I wonder how much of early conspiracy theory could have been averted if all those official mistakes hadn't been made. I'd be willing to bet that Edward Epstein would never have become a conspiracy theorist if the landscape hadn't been so littered with half-facts and false leads created by official bungling. Sylvia Marr, I'm less sure about. It's quite possible that she might have become a conspiracy theorist anyway, even if the authorities had given her less junk information to go on. But there certainly would have been a much smaller audience for her book, and for other books like it, if the Warren Commission hadn't made Americans wait so long to hear the simple, non-conspiratorial explanations that were clear to it almost from the word go. Mark Lane, of course, would have always been a conspiracy theorist no matter what. Most of his claims weren't based on an honest reading of the evidence in the first place, so a change in the evidence wouldn't have stopped him. Nothing would have stopped him, partly because he stopped at nothing himself. And nothing could stop the idea that Kennedy had been shot from in front. The original spark for that idea had come from Dr. Perry's observation that the throat wound looked like an entrance wound. Perry's claim was made in the heat of the moment, and when it was exposed to scrutiny, it quickly shriveled up and died. But the idea of the frontal shot, the shot from the grassy knoll, somehow managed to live on. It became a zombie idea, propped up by wish thinking rather than facts, and it lumbered on ahead in search of new scraps of evidence to feed on. If the throat wound no longer worked for it, then maybe the throat bullet would. As time went by, conspiracy theorists became increasingly fixated on that mysterious bullet that had turned up on that stretcher at Parkland Hospital. If this was the bullet that had caused the wounds in Kennedy's back and throat, why did it look so miraculously pristine? And by the way, how had it ended up on the stretcher? If it hadn't got there by falling out of the hole in Kennedy's back, how else had it got there? The stretcher bullet was about to become known as the single bullet. In fact, it was about to become the most famous bullet in history. And we'll be talking about that bullet next time on The Ghosts of Dallas.
Why did you get in such a rush?
Well, I've just worn out fighting over that damn report, trying to prove it. Same bullet that hit Kennedy first was the one that hit Connally. Went through him, through his hand, his bone, into his leg. And...
Well, what difference did it make which bullet got Connally?
Well, it don't make much difference, but they said that they believe, that the commission believed that the same bullet that hit Kennedy hit Connally. Well, I don't believe it.
I don't either.